Welcome to Word Labs Out Loud, your weekly dose of creative writing inspiration on CFRC 101.9. Operating under the aegis of Kingston Literacy and Skills, Word Labs is focused on building a supportive, community-driven literary space that people can access across the calendar year. Our goal is to provide an inclusive, supportive space for people from all backgrounds to grow their writing skills, share their stories, and connect in a relaxed, judgment-free environment. Workshop instructors and facilitators from the local community provide participants with a breadth of teaching styles, class formats, subject matter, and perspectives. Today's show will feature part two of our launch conversation on the value of creative writing with authors and artists Adrienne Michael Kelly, Eric McBay Wilding, Bruce Kaufman, and Jermaine Marshall. If you missed the first episode, check out our show archives.
Well, I've been thinking about the whole voiceless thing. You know, I, again, being an improviser, I'm constantly pivoting into a different voice. And I think what's so fascinating about that, too, is I can address, you know, say, let's use world issues again, because that's on everyone's minds. You know, I can pivot pretty quickly into a different character, which gives me a different voice. And what I find really fascinating about that is when I pivot on the fly into a different character, I really quickly become that character, and I am seeing the world through that character's eyes. So I'm always fascinated by how that can translate into being able to write characters. I had the amazing opportunity last year to teach writing with Wilding through an improv lens. One thing that I found was that while people had great characters, they didn't have the tools to get into that voice. Or like you said you talk to yourself all the time. Mm-hmm. I'm constantly talking to myself too. Mm-hmm. And I've tapped into over the years that I'm talking to myself in different voices as different characters. Like, I'm definitely multi, and there's like many people in this body.
Would you say it makes it easier to create forward motion in a narrative? Whereas, like, a lot of times people create characters and they don't know how to get them to do things. Whereas
exactly.
The process of kind of talking to oneself, having to maintain a self-dialogue, allows you in your writing to then be, or in your improv, to be like, oh, I know how to get this scene started and keep it going. Whereas somebody can make a really great character and it's like, how are they interacting with the people and things around them? Is this moving anywhere?
Well, you should teach with me. Very similar, same brain, right? Like, I always teach that, you know, something always happened to you before you came into the scene, and something's going to happen to your character afterwards. And I always teach to, like, ing your what's happening. So put an ing on it, especially in improv, because you're in the moment, right? So improv is generally just you on stage. You know, Tony and I break those rules constantly because we met online during COVID, so we now pay homage to our wigs and our costume pieces, and we have like 800 glasses, and, you know, we still use those things. But, you know, what tends to happen is people don't also ask enough questions about themselves as a character or a character they're writing, right? So I also do this great exercise, which helps with writers. It turns out it's called layer cake. You can imagine you make games, so it made me think of, you know, who here has played a video game or knows that a lot of times when you're creating a character, it's like a blank silhouette on like a salad spinner, right? So it's just nothing's on it, right? So layer cake gets everyone's in a circle, and let's say Bruce started in the circle. Bruce isn't Bruce. By the end, we've all given Bruce different things for that character. And again, out of that comes the character's voice. So we start with a name, who you are, and we add on things, anything, right? So you could give Bruce an article of clothing. You could give Bruce a feeling. You could give Bruce something that happened in the past. You take all of that, and then you say your first line of dialogue as that character. But if I just said to you, Bruce, you're blankety blank, a chemical engineer, tell me your first line of dialogue, right? You would be like, because it's not in there yet. So I think by tapping into, and, you know, not everyone has to agree with this, but I do think there's more than one voice in all of us. And I do think it's great to have those conversations with yourself, but improv lets them come out, right? And so I think a lot of times when you're trying to write about a character and you don't know anything about that character, so say we wanted to write about Bruce being a chemical engineer, I know absolutely nothing about being a chemical engineer. I could make it up, but it also helps to, like, maybe someone in the room knows something about being a chemical engineer, right? So we're all learning from each other, too, and we can give voice to that character from experience, as opposed to just, say, throwing you into the moment and going, you have to know everything about Bruce, the chemical engineer, right? But the biggest thing to get to that voice is you have to know what happened to that character before, and don't stop asking why.
David Mitchell was in Kingston, I don't know how many years ago now, but advice that he gave, which I think is along those lines, was he writes letters to his characters mm-hmm. as other characters.
That's cool.
And how do they reply to it? Because it's like, how do I speak to my mother? How do I speak to a colleague? How do I speak to my best friend? How do I speak to, like, this person I'm estranged with? And it's that same kind of thing of a creative way of developing individual characters and finding their voices. So
I love that. Yeah. That's really cool.
That one's always stuck with me.
Along that continuum, if you're in a group chat online, that's another really great way to think of writing character dialogue and interactions. And just look at how you interact in a group chat online versus the people who are in that group chat. With a work group chat versus a friend group chat, because then again you're creating dimensions to a character who this is how they are in the workplace versus how they are with their friends. I'm somebody who I'm pretty similar across both because I'm very consistent. You know, the me you see, the me you'll get. But that in and of itself is a character trait that can be reflected in how I write in those chats, in those dialogues.
That's actually a really great suggestion.
There's a story idea. There's so many unwritten things, but there's a story idea around that, and a narrative based on that that I've been thinking a lot about. Especially as there's so many really great ways to write stories now and share them. But I wanted to go back to something that Adrian said about memory. There's a show that I really quite enjoy. I highly, highly recommend it. Called Interview with a Vampire, and I heard some responses. Has anyone here watched it?
Long time ago, yeah.
Sure. Not the movie, there's a new TV show.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
It's very good. there's a line in it where the interviewer, because it's a bit of an odyssey through a vampire's memory, they talk about, you know, the odyssey of recollection. And I recently did a talk with Danny Ramadan about his memoir. And I wonder how much about finding your voice involves having to go through your memory. Because sometimes I find that going through my memory, moments where I'm like, oh, I actually wasn't okay with that. Or actually, I would have played that differently. Or, ooh, I didn't remember this aspect of this thing until this person told me about it. I was so sure the day had been rainy, but you're right, it was sunny. So sometimes finding my voice and finding its, I guess, flaws, pitchiness, so to speak, is in conversations with other people going through my memory. But, you know, you've written a memoir, so I'm curious, did you find that road smooth? Was it bumpy? Did you find your memory as reliable as you were expecting it to be, and how did you navigate the surprises of memory?
Yeah, no, those are all wonderful questions. It's not a smooth road, it's a very bumpy road. And memory is a creative faculty. It's not a recreative faculty, it's an imaginative faculty. You're often making up a memory rather than just recalling something or recollecting something. Or you could deconstruct that word to recollect. And it has an interesting snowball momentum memory. There were times, the more you remember, the more you remember, to the point at which it can become kind of maddening. There were mornings when I was in the shower remembering so much about my life that I thought I had forgotten, that I thought I'm gonna go mental. And if I try to record half of the stuff that's coming to me while I'm in the shower, it will be page 3000, I'm still 5 years old. or like Tristram Shandy, I'm on page 289 and yet to be born. The most fascinating thing that I find about voice is the way in which it almost needs to surprise you. I'm fascinated by the way in which form, style, grammar, syntax, intervening in grammar and syntax, to say nothing of rhythm and cadence, sound above all else, forces me at any rate, to remember more accurately than I thought I had been remembering. There's something about the nature of the sentence itself, and I would look at it and I would say to myself, I don't want to have any access to grind here. If anyone comes off badly, and maybe it's me you're looking at it, but I did at times write about other people, of course. And I wanted to be very, very careful that I wasn't egregiously misrepresenting anyone or anything. And so I was constantly asking myself, is this true? And I could look at it at an event as I had written it, and I thought that, you know, by draft 33, I was pretty good. But I would look at it and say, yeah, that's true. That more or less happened that way. That bears the family resemblance to what happened. But something about this is not right. And it was not by fixing the memory, it was by fixing the prose that the truth of that which happened, or at least the truthfulness, the maximum amount of truthfulness that I could evoke, manifested itself by paying the closest possible attention I could to the prose. I'm sure many of you in the room have read George Saunders, and who's also a wonderfully affable interviewee. And he talks about that sort of internal meter that you develop as a writer, and you make a statement that you feel to be true, but then you go back to that same statement the next day, and the meter's just saying, it's not right. It's not right. The sound of it is off, but it's more than just the sound. The sense in the sound of it is off, too. It's not fully true yet. He uses a very simple example. At one point, he says, I write a sentence, Fred was an asshole. Yeah. And he says, yeah, goddammit, Fred was an asshole. And you feel self-righteous and wonderful, and you've made your judgment and everything. And then you come back the next day and say, it's a really simplistic sentence. And it's just something's not right about that sentence. And then he's forced to remember, as he's rewriting the sentence, the memory doesn't come first. He rewrites the sentence first. And it's, well, Fred acted in an ornery way that particular day, which was 3 weeks after his son died. And then you see how suddenly things begin to get more complex. And the sentence grows to some extent in complexity, although sometimes what you may need to do is to simplify the sentence. Maybe you've been too proud of yourself and your ability to generate clause upon clause upon clause. And it could be a form of obfuscation. But again, you're paying attention to pretty essential things, things that are a lot older than you and more important than you. Narrative, myth, sound, rhythm. Rhythm is absolutely essential. And in attending to those features of the prose, only that way, only therein, does truth begin to emerge, or at least the maximum amount of truthfulness. And so often I had the memories sort of right, but they didn't ring entirely true until I had rewritten and rewritten and rewritten the sentences. And in that act, and in that act alone, did the memory emerge fully in its most resonant way for me, but also, more importantly, I hope, for you, the reader.
Well, is it because it held the maximum multitudes of meanings that you wanted to make and make accessible to the reader? Because I found that in previous works, there's one that I wrote about the experience of growing up in Pentecost, Caribbean Pentecost, where a lot of beating culture, like, you know, hitting kids that are disruptive, is very commonplace. So I wrote a piece about that when I was in a particularly angry space, and it was very, very, folks loved it, folks, you know, shed tears over it, and I was like, ooh. But then I remember once after I recited it, someone was like, oh, you know, it's so horrible that you have to be around such terrible people, and I'm like, oh, wait, no, ooh, no, this is my community, this is an aspect of my experience of this thing, but I don't like how this is generating an image of this memory in your mind, and so I have yet to finish revamping it. I'm not going to perform it again until I've done those changes that make the meaning that I want to get across. But to your point, it's, you know, you make it and then you start to look at it and share it. This isn't right. And I think sometimes that process happens after you thought you were finished with it, which comes as, I think, a surprise to yourself and oftentimes your audience, or you're like, oh, actually, the thing that I wrote many years ago, I have new meaning about it generated now.
Yeah. I mean, paradoxically, it's an act of authority. You are the author of the book to represent the memory or the scene, if it's a scene in fiction. But you also, at a certain point, need to be able to let go of authority in terms of putting some sort of final authoritative stamp on the memory or the experience or the scene, because that belongs to you. And I want you to make your own conclusions about what may have happened in a particular scene that I'm evoking from my life. So the writing becomes less informative and more evocative. And it's less a case of this is what happened than it is of an opening of a kind of a two-way street here involving human empathy. feeling to feeling.
Eric, I want to give you a chance. We're actually getting close to time, which is amazing.
Lord.
This has been such a great conversation.
I think for me, being able to write with a distinctive voice or voices and doing that consistently is really important for both creativity and for job security. So, you know, we were speaking a little bit about characters before, and I think if I'm writing dialogue in fiction, then it's important for me that each of those characters have a distinctive and recognizable voice. You know, if I can print out my draft and take a Sharpie and, like, scrub out all of the character names, and someone reads that scene and there are four characters and they can tell without the name cues who each person is because they speak in such a distinctive way, that makes for really powerful characterization, and I think it makes for more engaging writing. But one of the key reasons I think in this moment it's important to be able to develop a distinctive voice is because of ChatGPT. So if you're a writer or if you want to be a writer or especially a working writer and make a living from it, ChatGPT is a big problem because it does superficially a lot of the same things that writers do, even that good writers do, right? It has an expansive vocabulary. It can reference a lot of different things. It's extremely fast. Of course, the challenge is that it lies prolifically because it doesn't know what's true and what's not true. And fundamentally, it has no kind of internal sense of reason or justice and no external senses like smell or taste. So one of the things that I think about when I'm writing is I try to write whatever I'm writing in a way ChatGPT would be incapable of imitating. Whether that means it's like displaying some genuine human feeling or like an internal kind of human state and experience that a machine can't imitate, or even if it's grounded in the ways that we are human bodies, that we have senses and we smell things and all of that. I think that's really important, and increasingly, I think that's going to be necessary for us to show it it's worth paying us to write when ChatGPT will do it for free. And it's also important to write in a way that's visibly human, so that people are less pulled in by the kind of the fakeness, the pervasive fakeness that's flooding the internet, right? Apparently, this is the biggest challenge for AI companies right now, is so much of the text on the internet is made by other, like, large language models. So they're feeding it in to the machines again, and it's just kind of gumming up the works with all of this garbage feedback. So, yeah, I think for me that distinctive voice also has to do with being human and not a machine that's plagiarizing humans.
Very quickly, creative writing or the idea, I think, of being an author or an artist of any kind can be a very intimidating thing. And that idea of, like, how do I even start? What advice would you give for someone who wants to explore creative risk-taking?
Well, I'm going to be really bold and lean into a nickname a lot of people have for me. I'm the improv pusher. And, I mean, I think whether you're going to be an improviser or you just want to use it as a life skill, like how I've been able to teach it over the last few years, I really think try improv. Era, I pitched my workshop to Era last year, and I mean, she was really into it right away and saw the benefit and that writers would see it too. And it really did. And I mean, one of the biggest things that happened in that workshop was people, again, coming together and going, wow, I didn't realize how lonely I am as a writer and how I've clutched this to my chest for so long. And then finding other people in the room that felt the same way, and also like offering a different way to write and to actually connect with your characters. I think improv is such a great way to, one thing I've heard that you were saying, Adrian, and I'm gonna somewhat contradict myself because I do believe there has to be so much structure and control and respecting your own experiences and other people's experiences. But what's so great about improv is letting go of control, right? So for instance, someone might be like, I'm stuck. And there was this one guy in the workshop, and I can't remember the scenario, but he explained what was going on between these two characters, and he was stuck, and he was willing to share a little bit about his story. And again, we didn't need to know what it was called, or we didn't know anything about the book, but we knew he was stuck on these two characters, and he shared a little bit, and, you know, five or six other people offered. And he was like, wow, I never even thought about that, you know, and then we kind of unofficially started layer caking his characters, and like, he didn't really know anything about them. And he admitted he wanted to write about these two teenagers that lived in a small town and were troublemakers. That's all he knew. But he didn't know how they knew each other. He didn't know why they were troublemakers. He didn't know anything about their past. So by the end of the workshop, he had fully formed characters. And it kind of blew people away because they're like, you could write about, anyone could write about two troubled teenagers, but we don't know anything about them, right? We don't know how they came to know each other, why they're doing these things. And so I think it's really fascinating when you can get together in a room. And again, people tend to be scared of improv if you don't know that it's not just a form of performance. I'm not going to make you perform. I'm going to make you let go of control. And I'm going to let you turn the control over to other people. And we're in the moment together creating. And you can take, you know, I said to the room, this person that's sharing, thank you for sharing, you can take some of this or not take it. And somebody was like, wow, now I can push them off the cliff and see where they land, because he knows how they ended up in that moment, but he didn't know anything else. So definitely, whether it's my improv workshop or someone else's, but I definitely think learning how to write in the moment, whether you're actually going to use that or not. But it's so freeing. You just let go. And sometimes you cling so hard to like a plot or characters and they're just not honest.
Yeah.
Right, no, to what you said.
I would echo this completely. A former partner of mine, don't worry, we're still on good terms, was an improv artist in New York City and took me along to a few of her workshops. And being around other people makes it a little easier for you to let go of control and play. It's a very permissive space, and I found it immensely liberating, not to mention fun as hell. Uh-huh.
And I didn't mean to say that. Yet.
But to bring some of that spirit into the study when I'm alone, and to give myself that permission to play. I mean, who's watching? It's only your internal critic that's watching, and improv is going to help to let you tell the inner critic to F off, you know, and to play. So if you really feel you're stuck, do imitate a little bit. Take the first line of somebody else's poem, or the first line or the last line of a story. Write it down and keep going. You know, rewrite the poem, rewrite the story. And it doesn't matter how contradictory it may be, how good it is you think, how bad it may be, according to you. Just learn how to keep your pen moving in the face of resistance. Learn how to keep your pen moving in the face of that internal critic, which will really quite quickly actually shut up once you actually begin moving your hand.
I do have to run, but this has been a really great afternoon, and I look forward to seeing some faces again, familiar faces, during some of the workshops. I just go back to the review exercise and just, I think, getting in touch with your inner critic. Because oftentimes in a world that conditions us to conform to other voices than our own, we can sometimes find what we actually think about things through our anger or our sadness, or oftentimes the negative emotions that can become a vehicle for our voice. And so if you, again, if you've read a book, watched a show, gone to an event, you know, or even are at a workplace and you want to like write, again, just a creative project for yourself, a review of your workplace, of your friend group, again, it may sound a little bit strange, but you can actually go through that process to get a better sense of how do you think about things, how do you feel about things. You can tear it up afterwards, set it on fire, but start talking to yourself in that way, getting really candid with how you think about things and how you're experiencing things, how you like them and how you dislike them. For some of the reviews, if you feel comfortable and safe to, you can share with your friends or your group to say, hey, I wrote a review of this movie that we watched. What do you guys think about this? Again, start to give your voice space to practice and exercise. And with that being said, I bid you all adieu. Bye.
What an
exercise.
Bye.
My advice for creative risk taking is to engage in literary prototyping. So in the digital games world, if we had 10 days and we were trying to decide what a new game was going to be, we wouldn't spend 10 days working, making one prototype fancy. We would use that time to make like 5 prototypes or even 10 prototypes that were totally different. And so my advice for you is to write in a bunch of different genres and styles and formats and try it out and see how you feel, see what you engage with, see what connects with you. And then you can pursue that and develop it further. And even those things, those prototypes that you don't pursue, you learn things from them, right? We can cross-pollinate by writing in different genres. And even though this is a form of risk-taking to do something new, in my work, it's considered de-risking. Because the risky thing is that you almost made an amazing game, but you didn't explore enough, so you made this other game that was just fine. So the real risk is like missing out on something that could be new and exciting and challenging. And that also helps put it in perspective when you're doing something that feels uncomfortable or tough at first.
I have a question. I've heard some of you say, put a pen down, tear it up, whatever. How many of you, when you're doing your best work, are actually writing on paper, and how many are at the computer?
Always on paper.
The same, actually.
I write on the computer, and if I'm writing longhand, it's with like a stylus.
Because it's paper.
Yeah. It's digital paper.
It's paper adjacent. You're saving trees.
Yeah, exactly.
Early drafts always on paper, even though I have chronic tendonitis. But and the journaling, absolutely. And I'm not necessarily an empiricist or a data-driven type, but there actually is really interesting data on kind of the connection, as it were, to your unconscious, or if you prefer, maybe your shadow self, made by this motion as opposed to that motion. That said, I do know people who swear by this, especially if they're speedy typists, but I find that I self-edit too much when I'm composing immediately on the computer. I can do it with journalism, but when it comes to fiction or anything that's sort of image-driven or that's involving a lot of just figuration, I've got to start longhand, for sure.
And I might just add one thing to that risk-taking thing, and it's kind of probably contrary to a lot of what we've talked about tonight, but it's the best advice that I think I've ever gotten. I will add one thing to it. I think that walking ahead of writing is essential, and especially out in nature. But the thing is to shut the mind off, just observe, absorb, and just catch these glimpses. There is every single thing in the world. There are millions of things that are all a story or a poem. And you might just catch a piece, but don't think about it. Just go someplace, finish your walk, and when you sit down, that will immediately explode into this whatever it was meant to be. And so that's my thing.
Sorry, I couldn't resist. But I can't remember who said this recently. I was reading an interview or watching one with a writer who got into William Faulkner's archives. And he was delighted because he said it. Yeah, I was looking at early drafts of The Sound and the Fury and these other canonical novels. And he said, I was so delighted they were terrible. So even this titanic genius. And it reminds me too of a comment made by a screenwriting teacher I know, and he has above his computer, write badly with pride. You've got to give yourself permission, and I fight with this every day. You've got to give yourself permission to write poorly. It's actually not poor. It's just a part of the process. I always have to pump dirty water before I get clean. And so give yourself permission to do that. I think too often it's the urge to perfection or shame regarding imperfection that prevents people from writing. It nearly killed my writing life for many, many, many years, a kind of perfectionist attitude that I had to learn how to defeat. And you can learn how to defeat it just by showing up and giving yourself permission to play.
Thank you for tuning in to Word Labs Out Loud this week for part two of our conversation about the value of creative writing. I've been your host, Ara McCauley, and this is Word Labs Out Loud.